Welcome to the debate. You know, usually when we talk about a medical diagnosis, there's this this expectation of precision.
Right, yeah.
It's like engineering. You know, you break your arm, the x-ray shows that jagged white line, and the doctor points at it and says, there it is. There is the problem.
Exactly. It's binary. It's, well, broken or not broken. It's clean and, frankly, it's comforting. We really like things to be visible and easily categorized like that.
We do. But then you step into the world of chronic illness, right? Metabolic dysfunction, systemic biological failure. And suddenly that x-ray machine it's useless. We're looking at a diagnostic landscape that is incredibly murky and deeply interconnected.
Yeah, it is the absolute definition of diagnostic muddy waters.
Right. And that brings us to the focal material for our discussion today. We're diving into a brand new paper by Dr. Bichar Sahali that just dropped today, actually, May 4th, 2026. It's titled From Autopoiesis to Living Coherence, a Maturon and Biological Framework for Disease, Healing, and Non-Forcing Action.
It's a mouthful, but it is, yeah, but it challenges the very foundation of how we conceptualize health and medical intervention.
It certainly swings for the fences. I mean, taking the biology of cognition, specifically the work of Humberto Maturana, right, and attempting to just map it onto the entirety of contemporary medical science, that is ambitious.
Precisely, because modern medicine operates heavily on a model of a targeted intervention. We identify a defective mechanism, like a broken part in the machine, and we apply an external force to correct it.
Right, the fix-it model. Exactly. But Dr. Zahali's paper proposes a radical shift. It argues that we should view organisms as structurally determined unities and reframe health not as a static baseline, but as the dynamic conservation of a viable coupling between an organism and its environment.
Which leads us to the central tension we're navigating today, I think. Does redefining disease as a costly conserved drift and clinical treatment as non-forcing action provide a more accurate paradigm for modern medicine? Or does it, you know, risk a philosophical abstraction that actually undermines the urgent, targeted interventions necessary in acute care?
Well, I'll lay my cards on the table right here in a single sentence. My position is that the Living Coherence Framework is a vital evolution for medicine. It correctly identifies that chronic diseases are self-reinforcing adaptations, requiring us to work with the living organization rather than just, you know, forcing change from the outside.
And my contrasting position is this. While the framework offers a beautiful ecological perspective on chronic stress, emphasizing concepts like non-forcing action really risks minimizing the brute mechanical reality of disease. And that could potentially lead to a dangerous therapeutic passivity when decisive control is exactly what a patient needs.
Okay, to really grasp the clinical applications here, we have to unpack the biological grammar Sahali is using.
Right, the Maturana terms.
Yeah, the traditional biomedical model treats the body like an input-output machine, like a computer. But living systems are defined by what Maturana called autopoiesis. They are literally self-producing. A cell continuously producing the very components that define it as a cell. And because of this, organisms possess structural determination.
Let's clarify what that actually means in practice, because it's a pretty heavy term.
Sure. It means your body isn't a computer executing a virus's code. If a virus enters your body, or say, if you take a pharmaceutical drug, that external event acts as a trigger. It perturbs the system.
Right, it kicks things off.
Exactly, but it does not instruct the organism's response. The organism decides how to adapt based entirely on its own internal structure and, well, everything it has ever experienced. It is a living entity adapting to a trigger, not a machine receiving a command.
That is a crucial distinction. You can't just program a biological system like you write software.
No, you can't. And from that insight, the paper constructs a 6-stage grammar of disease. It explains how a trigger, like a chronic nutritional imbalance or relentless psychological stress, forces the organism to compensate.
It adapts to survive.
Right. The organism alters its baseline to survive that specific moment. But over time, that compensation builds what is called an allostatic load. The physiological cost of surviving starts to accumulate.
Yeah, the wear and tear.
Exactly. So what we end up calling a chronic disease, like insulin resistance or hypertension, is actually a costly conserved pattern. The organism is successfully surviving in the short term, but at the expense of its global coherence. So healing can't just be about throwing a chemical at a symptom to suppress it. It has to be about restoring the organism's viable relationship with its environment.
Well, I don't disagree with the concept of allostatic load. I mean, the idea of how adaptive stress responses become damaging over time, that is perfectly valid stress physiology.
Right.
But applying this Maturinian grammar to the entirety of human pathology, that is an overreach. The text itself actually has a limits and safeguards section that explicitly warns against romanticizing disease, noting that infections and structural violence are very real.
Of course, yeah. The framework doesn't deny physical trauma.
No, but it struggles to incorporate that reality cleanly. I mean, a malignant tumor or a congenital genetic defect like cystic fibrosis, that is not a conserved history of coupling. It is a catastrophic biological error.
And asserting that non-forcing action, you know, the Taoist concept of Wu Wei, is the ideal clinical approach sounds incredibly appealing in a philosophy seminar. But in the face of an acute bacterial sepsis, the concept of disciplined participation in the autonomy of living systems is frankly far less clinically useful than a direct, highly forcing intervention.
But a scalpel doesn't participate in autonomy, you know? It cuts out the dying tissue so the host survives. Broad-spectrum antibiotics don't coax the system, they carpet-bomb the pathogen.
That's an interesting point, though I would frame it differently, because I think you're conflating forcing action with effective action. The paper argues that even our most aggressive tools are fundamentally misunderstood. Let's look at how this framework redefines specific biological systems, starting with how the body defends itself.
Okay, immunology.
Right. Classical immunology leans heavily on a militaristic model. It's the army of the body, discerning self from non-self and destroying the invader.
And that militaristic model has given us vaccines, organ transplants, and immunotherapies.
It has, absolutely. But it is fundamentally incomplete. Using concepts from Vaz and Varela, the paper posits that immunity is actually relational identity conservation.
Relational identity.
Yeah. Think of it this way. The immune system is less like a border patrol shooting anything that crosses a line and more like a highly sophisticated diplomat.
A diplomat?
Yes, this diplomat is managing our relationship with food proteins, with trillions of commensal gut microbes, with routine tissue repair, even with the bizarre biological paradox of pregnancy, right? Where a foreign entity grows inside the host without being attacked.
True, pregnancy is a unique immune state.
Exactly. Inflammation, in this view, is not just a weapon of destruction, it's a signaling and reorganization process. So when phenomena like autoimmunity or allergies occur, it isn't just the army malfunctioning, it's an immune mode that has lost its coherent relationship with the organism's environment.
I'm sorry, but I just don't buy that. Let me tell you why.
Okay.
The diplomat analogy is clever. And yes, immune tolerance is a real complex phenomenon. But the militaristic model remains incredibly effective precisely because some threats are in fact invading enemies.
But are they enemies or just incompatible perturbations?
They're enemies. Imagine a patient undergoing a massive graft versus host response after a bone marrow transplant. Or their immune system is literally liquefying their own lung tissue during a severe viral pneumonia. Reframing the immune response as an identity and relation that has simply become incongruent, that doesn't change the terrifying clinical reality on the ground.
I mean, no, it doesn't change the immediate crisis.
Right. And in that moment, you have to use immunosuppression. That is a literal chemical forcing action to stop tissue destruction. You are overriding the system's structural determination because its current structure is lethal.
I'm not convinced by that line of reasoning, though, because the paper explicitly states that immunosuppressives and biologics are valid tools.
So it admits forcing is necessary.
No, the distinction is in how we conceptualize what those tools are doing. If we just see the immune system as an army, we think suppressing it is the final cure, we declare victory and go home. But if we see it as relational identity conservation, we realize the immunosuppressive drug is just a temporary bridge.
A bridge to what?
It buys us time. It stops the immediate structural collapse so we can figure out why the organism's structural coupling lost coherence in the first place.
But you are still forcing the system.
Temporarily constraining it, yes. But let's zoom in further. Because this idea of misinterpreting the system's signals scales all the way down to the cellular level. If we zoom down from the immune cells patrolling the body into the very batteries powering them, the mitochondria, we see this exact same misconception playing out.
Ah, the powerhouse of the cell.
Exactly. For decades, we've taught that mitochondria are the command centers of the cell's energy production. But the text explicitly refrains them. They aren't the engine room dictating power. They are more like a cellular thermostat.
Okay. Sensing instead of commanding.
Right. A thermostat doesn't command the house. It senses the room's temperature and responds to it. Mitochondria are participants in bioenergetic conditions. They sense the metabolic needs of the cell and facilitate adaptation. And this ties perfectly into reactive oxygen species, or ROS, in redox biology.
Right, ROS, the molecules that cause oxidative stress.
Which we used to think were just toxic byproducts. We thought ROS was just metabolic exhaust, like rust in the machine. And we tried to pump people full of antioxidant pills to just block them.
We did do that in the 90s, yeah.
But this paper points out how deeply flawed that was. ROS are vital participants in physiological signaling. When a cell produces an oxidative burst, it isn't just taking damage. That ROS alters the shape of proteins to flip genetic switches, physically telling the cell, hey, we are under stress, build more of your own endogenous antioxidants.
It's an alarm bell.
Exactly. The body is using these supposed toxins to maintain its autopoiesis. Doesn't this prove that traditional medicine's attempt to simply block a mechanism with a pill is scientifically reductive?
That's a compelling argument, but have you considered that the field of contemporary redox biology is already doing this?
What do you mean?
I mean, we are already distinguishing regulatory redox signaling from oxidative stress, completely independent of Majorana's philosophy. We understand now that ROS follows what we call a biphasic dose response curve.
For the listener, explain what that curve means in this context.
It's basically the Goldilocks principle of biology. A little bit of a stressor acts like an alarm bell. It wakes up the cellular defenses and makes the system stronger. That's why exercise is good for you. It actually creates a small amount of ROS.
Right.
But a massive amount of ROS? Well, that burns the house down and causes cellular death. We understand this now. My point is, we don't need a new dense philosophical lexicon of nested biological closures to understand that a signaling molecule behaves differently at different concentrations.
I think we do, though.
Why? We just need better, more precise, targeted pharmacology. The failure of broad antioxidant therapies wasn't a failure of our fundamental medical paradigm. It was just a blunt tool. As our molecular understanding improves, our tools become sharper.
But pharmacology alone cannot solve systemic ecological issues. And that's where the jargon you just mentioned, nested closures, becomes so powerful and, frankly, necessary.
How so? Explain why we need that specific phrasing.
Because it forces us to remember the scale of the problem. A nested closure just means a mitochondrion is a system nested inside an immune cell, which is nested inside an organ, which is nested inside a human, who is nested inside an environment.
It's turtles all the way down.
Exactly. You can't just isolate the chemical reaction. The text introduces this as the organism microbe niche unity. We are not isolated individuals inside an external environment. We are a historically constituted unity with our microbes and our surroundings.
I agree that the organism niche unity is a powerful lens, particularly when looking at something like the gut microbiome.
Right. Think about dysbiosis. If someone's gut microbiome fails, it isn't just the presence of bad bacteria that you can nuke with an antibiotic pill. It is a disturbed pattern of coupling. The terrain itself has changed.
Usually due to lifestyle.
Yes. It's influenced by their diet, their sleep architecture, their physical movement, and, incredibly, their sense of relational safety. Linear targeted interventions fail here because they completely ignore the operational wholeness of the system. You can't fix a disturbed organism niche coupling by just manipulating one molecular pathway because the environment is still sending the same destructive signals.
I come at it from a different way. I think most modern physicians would completely agree that ecological factors, diet and sleep, are profoundly crucial. No one is debating the value of preventative medicine or treating the terrain.
True, but...
But I question the operational reality of healing in this Maturanan context when we are dealing with active disease. The text permits the use of medical interventions. It concedes antibiotics are sometimes necessary. But if we are still relying on the exact same tools, the same antibiotics, the same surgical procedures, isn't labeling that intervention a congruent perturbation rather than a linear intervention, just a semantic game? It feels like we are softening the harsh realities of medical science with, well, philosophical poetry.
I see why you think that, but let me give you a different perspective. It is absolutely not just semantics. The intent and the context of the tool radically changes its biological impact. This gets to the heart of Wu Wei, or non-forcing action.
An antibiotic lyses a bacterial cell wall regardless of your philosophical intent.
Chronic pain or chronic inflammation. Imagine a patient who works manual labor, say construction, and they have a structurally failing knee joint.
Very common.
Right. Under the traditional forcing model, we give them a corticosteroid injection or a heavy painkiller. We suppress the pain signal indefinitely so they can keep working that job. We are forcing the organism into a maladaptive drift. We have stripped away the system's feedback mechanism, and the joint will eventually be destroyed.
Okay, so how does Wu Wei actually change that?
Non-forcing action means using the tool to reduce constraints rather than impose an artificial baseline. You might still use the painkiller, but temporarily. You use it to allow the patient to engage in physical therapy, acting with the organism's timing and readiness. You don't force the joint to work under the same destructive load. You remove the constraint so the system can self-organize and heal. And this goes even deeper into affective neuroscience.
Ah, the paper's integration of Jack Panksepp and Antonio Damasio.
Yes. The text points out that our emotions aren't just abstract thoughts in our heads. They literally configure our physical biology. Chronic fear, humiliation, or social exclusion, these alter our physiology.
The physiological toll of stress.
Exactly. If a person is constantly stressed, their body pumps out cortisol, shifts blood flow away from digestion, and locks the immune system into a defensive posture. In this state, healing is biologically deprioritized. It physically narrows the viable actions an organism can take. Wu Wei in medicine means creating conditions of safety, dignity, and care, because those are literal biological prerequisites for the nervous system to switch gears and allow the body to heal. You can't force a system out of chronic fear with a pill.
I genuinely think the integration of affective neuroscience is one of the strongest and most vital parts of the paper. Recognizing that emotional safety is a biological necessity is profound.
It really is.
But from a clinical standpoint, how does an ER physician evaluate increases in coherence over the immediate control of vital signs?
Well, the paper doesn't suggest ignoring vital signs.
No, but the emphasis shifts. Imagine a patient crashing in the ICU, rapidly deteriorating from an autoimmune flare. Providing supportive conditions like relational safety and circadian alignment is wonderful, but it is entirely secondary to stabilizing their vitals.
Of course.
The text itself warns against vague holism. My fear is that if a physician holds back on forcing actions out of a desire to respect a patient's structural determination, it could cost lives in critical windows. The paradigm works beautifully for understanding the slow accumulation of allostatic load, but it becomes potentially hazardous if we apply it to the sharp end of acute pathology. A mechanical ventilator is a massive forcing action. We literally paralyze the patient to intubate them. That is the ultimate external control.
That is a valid concern, which is exactly why the paper explicitly warns that non-forcing action should not be confused with therapeutic passivity.
Okay.
But even in the ICU, the philosophical shift matters. When you put a patient on a ventilator, the goal isn't just to force the numbers on the monitor to look normal so you can pat yourself on the back. You are applying a temporary external constraint to preserve the living organization. The machine breathes for them so their tissues don't die, creating the space for their own structural coherence to reorganize.
So the forcing action is just a prerequisite for the non-forcing healing?
Precisely. The framework doesn't outlaw the ventilator. It changes how we view the trajectory of recovery. It asks, once the acute crisis is managed, what are the organism niche conditions that will maintain a new viable attractor?
Right. What comes after?
Yeah. If you're listening right now and wondering what ancient Taoist philosophy has to do with an emergency room visit, it's this. You can't just fix the immediate crisis, send the patient back to the exact same environment, the exact same stress loads, and the exact same relational humiliation that caused the biological collapse in the first place, and expect the pills to magically work. You have to treat the whole system.
On that, we are in complete agreement. The transition from acute stabilization to chronic rehabilitation requires a fundamentally different lens. And Dr. Solly's concept of the organism niche unity is a really powerful way to visualize why patients bounce right back into the hospital when their environment remains toxic.
As we draw this discussion to a close, I think it's important to synthesize where we've landed. My summary of the material is this. Dr. Sahali's application of Maturana's biology is an indispensable evolution for medical science. By understanding chronic disease not simply as a random breakdown of parts, but as a costly conserved drift, you know, an organism desperately trying to survive under compounding constraints, we fundamentally change the nature of care. It allows medicine to move beyond merely fighting the body and blindly suppressing signals. Through non-forcing action, we can authentically support the organism in restoring a viable living coherence with its environment. It respects the true, interconnected complexity of life.
And my summary remains grounded in clinical pragmatism. The living coherence framework beautifully articulates the sheer complexity of chronic stress, allostatic load, and the reality that a patient cannot be separated from their environment.
Right.
It is a vital warning against medical hubris and the limitations of reductionism. However, it struggles to completely replace the practical efficacy of the targeted biomedical model. While we must heed the ecological warnings and prioritize the social determinants of health, we must absolutely retain the right to impose external forcing control on failing biological systems. Biology may be self-organizing, but sometimes that self-organization leads straight into a death spiral, and it is the absolute duty of medicine to interrupt that process decisively.
There is a deep, undeniable tension here. We are caught between appreciating the immense historical complexity of an organism's self-organization and the urgent clinical imperative to intervene to stop suffering.
It's the tension between the philosopher mapping the ecosystem and the surgeon stopping the bleed. Both are necessary, but they operate on very different timelines.
Absolutely. Dr. Sahli's paper ultimately challenges the fundamental vocabulary we use to describe healing. It's a dense, challenging text, and we've really only scratched the surface of the biological principles it details. We highly encourage you to dive into the source material yourself to decide whether modern medicine requires this kind of philosophical revolution or simply a sharper refinement of its existing tools.
It will certainly change the way you look at your next prescription or, you know, your next stressful week at work, for that matter.
It absolutely will. Think back to that x-ray machine we talked about at the beginning. We love the clean, jagged line of a broken bone because it tells us exactly where to apply force. But as we've explored today, when the disease isn't a broken bone but a slow, costly drift away from living coherence, applying blind force might just break the system further. The question isn't just where the fracture is. Well, it's whether we have the wisdom to know when to push, and when to step back and let the system heal itself.